Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
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 So verse 4 of chapter 19. As Prickett Maharaj was repenting like this, news of his imminent death due to Sringi's curse reached Maharaj Prickett. Samika Rishi had sent a messenger to inform the king of the irrevocable curse so that he might properly prepare himself for going back home, back to Godhead. Instead of trying to counteract the curse, Maharaj Prickett took it as a good opportunity to become indifferent towards all material things. Nimesha 3. In the purport to the fourth verse, Srila Prabhupada writes, Samika Muni sent news to the king that foolish Sringi, his son, although a powerful Brahmin boy, unfortunately had misused his spiritual power by cursing the king unwarrantedly. The incident of the king's garlanding the Muni was not sufficient cause for being cursed to death. But since there was no way to retract the curse, the king was informed to prepare for death within a week. Both Samika Muni and the king were self-realized souls. Samika Muni was a mystic, and Maharaj Prickett was a devotee. Therefore, there was no difference between them in self-realization. Neither of them was afraid of meeting death. Maharaj Prickett could have gone to the Muni to beg his pardon, but the news of imminent death was conveyed to the king with so much regret by the Muni that the king did not want to shame the Muni further by his presence there. He decided to prepare himself for his imminent death and find out the way to go back to Godhead. So now here is a point where Prabhupada mentioned that one's a mystic and one's a devotee, and they're both on the same level of self-realization. So in this, it would bring out two points. One is that the the position of realization of transcendence is the same for both, meaning that the devotee, because their self realizes, no less than the mystic yogi. Like that. At the same time, is that to be looked at the other way. In other words, if you're looking at it from the material platform, the tendency is to think that these great rishis and munis and that are very elevated devotees may or may not be, because they're just following this simple bhakti path, while the munis are following this very austere and very, you know, serious path. So they're more serious transcendentalists. So then, to adjust that, then it's being said they're on the same level. At the same time, as you have the element is that the devotee self-realization is on the same level as the mystic yogis and the impersonalists and that. But that's not the big thing. It's the doorway through which you get to prema. Does that make sense? In other words, you have a platform, this what we hear in English called self-realization. So, but in the Sanskrit, you'll have liberation, right, or mukti, and you'll have Brahma-bhuta. So liberation means you're freed from the material contamination. But Brahma-bhuta means you're freed from material contamination and situated on the path of bhakti. Right? So it's important to note that these different things of processes of transcendence are actually the same for the devotees, the mystics, the impersonalists, because it's the process of how to get out of the material world. Just like for a devotee to get on a bus and for a non-devotee to get on a bus, the process is the same. But why they're getting on the bus, they have differences. Does that make sense? So consciousness is the real element, not the externals of what form. Another thing to note is that Prabhupada said it's by the spiritual power. Sringi's son had misused his spiritual power. So they're mystics, and the son seems to be immature and somewhat materialistic, or at least mundane in his viewpoint, but still the results are spiritual. So one may say, well, how could it be spiritual? Then one could understand is that actually the process of self-realization is spiritual. But people who do not know that use it materially. Does that make some sense? Otherwise, how do you get this kid? This kid is the one that Kaliraj found suitable to enter, right? And he can't enter anywhere, right? You have to do something wrong to enter. Nala Maharaj, Kali was offended that Nala won Damayanti's hand over all the great demigods. And he went himself to hopefully try his luck, but he was late, and when he came, all the demigods were coming back and they were all smiling. So he said, oh, so then who won? You know, was it Indra? Was it Varuna? Was it like that? No, this guy Nala. Right? And the good demigods were smiling because they were so pleased with Damayanti's chastity that she had picked Nala, and she could have picked any demigod who would look like Nala. Right? You know, okay, you like what Nala looks like? Hey, I'll look like that. No, cool. No. But she said, no, I just want Nala. You know, I know he's human. I know he's going to die in a hunt, you know, in regular lifetime. I could marry a demigod, go to the heavenly planets. And no, she. So they were very pleased with that. But because it was a human being, then Kaliraj got upset and said, I'll teach this guy a lesson. So he had to wait and wait and wait. He could do nothing to Nala because he did everything properly. But one day when he was washing his feet after eating, he only washed the front part of his foot. Ever heard of that one? And didn't wash the heel, right? And so that means the heel of his foot was impure, so Kaliraj entered his body through his heel. So if anyone wants to wear the Shastric evidence why you should wash your whole foot after eating, here it is. So then, and so therefore we can understand from this story that he could only enter Sringi if there was something wrong, right? And then at the same time, as you see here, that he is he's powerful. He can curse an emperor to die he can call Takshaka, right? I mean, Takshaka is the number three snake in the universe. And that's after Ananta is the number one and he's dropped out, right? Means he's just gone off to do service. So that means Vasuki's number one and Takshaka becomes number two by default. So he's able to call the number two snake in the universe. So it's powerful. So it's very important to note that the devotional activities or any of these activities given in Shastra technically give a spiritual result because it's austerity and it's being performed according to Guru and Shastra. But because our consciousness may not be spiritual, therefore the spiritual potency is transferred into material. Right? That's why it's even recommended, though it's not recommended, it's recommended. In the first thing it means earlier is that even you want to be a gross materialist, still chant the holy name, worship Krishna. It's much more efficient. You know, you do yajnas and this and that, so many things. You'll only get a little bit of that. You worship the Lord, whatever you want, and more you'll get. But that means transferring spiritual things into material. The exchange rate's very high. Does that make some sense? So, in other words, devotional service is not something ordinary. It's actually the standard of the universe. Just people misapply it, misunderstand it, misuse it. Does that make sense? It's we feel, you know, okay, we're a few people, we're sitting here in Mayapur, we're a bunch of weirdos. But, you know, we're far enough out of the way, it doesn't matter. You know, like that. Does that make some sense? You know? But actually, the whole universe is being run by devotees. All the demigods, 33 million, they're all devotees. Neophytes, but devotees, nonetheless. And all the effects of things are actually devotional.
Does it make sense? If you're following the Shastra according to things that are for self-realization. So even you're an impersonalist, like down in, let's say, Guru Vayur, Shankaracharya established the worship there, and they take the deity out and do Hari Nam and everything like that, but they think they're going to, through this, then merge with the deity. You know? But in any case, it's very funny. All his other temples are all very dry and boring and, you know, typical Shankarite temples. But that one, because it's far enough out of the way, then I guess he had some fun. They all, you know, they sing Gita Govinda for the deities and, you know, do a 3-hour procession every night and, you know, all these things for the deities. Does that make some sense? Right? So the path is the same, but they drop off at liberation. Well, for the devotee, that's where devotional life actually becomes serious, because that's anartha nivritti. Means in the 9 processes, anartha nivritti comes in the first stage of madhyam. But it's basic, technically speaking, 60% purified. Right? 60%. But at bhava, which is liberation, then it's, you're 100% purified of anything gross, but there's still the flavor of material association. So that's the serious anartha nivritti. Does that make sense? Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, that's actually what you were talking about, is the real way to understand the term tattvavadi or tattvavad, which you know, is ascribed to the sampradaya of Sripad Madhvacharya. He says that actually there is no maya. He was so, you know, and of course one can say, well, this was his radical opposition, you know, doctrinal opposition to the impersonalist, but actually he's right.
Mm-hmm.
This material world, even we say as Vaishnavas, as Gaudiya Vaishnavas belonging to the same sampradaya as Sripad Madhvacharya, we say this is the world of maya, but that doesn't mean the same thing that the Mayavadis mean. The Mayavadis will also say, yes, this is the world of maya, but they mean that it's an absolute hallucination. It is not real. It is not based on any foundation. It is a pure dream, you see. Whereas the Vaishnava definition of illusion, as in, say, Madhvacharya Sampradaya, is that because everything is based on Krishna, therefore even maya has consequences, has real consequences. You're, in truth, an eternal servant of Krishna. You have the choice of serving Krishna or not. So if you choose not to serve Krishna, that's maya. Maya means that which is not. So you have chosen a position which is not real for you. To say, no, I'm not going to serve Krishna, that is constitutionally an unreal position. But that doesn't mean that there's no consequence. There's no real consequence. You're just in some, you know, floating in some kind of hallucination. But actually, you are really suffering. You are really getting karma. You are really being pounded by the material nature. And she has a real intent to bring you back to the same position. And she's not going to stop pounding you until you find the surrender. And that's the difficulty of this Mayavadi philosophy, because the Mayavadis, the more they get pounded, the more they say, oh, this is just illusion, this isn't real. So Maya Devi's pounding them worse and worse and worse and worse and pulverizing them, you see. So actually, For the devotee recognizes that everything is the Lord and His energy. That is our philosophy. It's called technically Shakti Parinama Vada. That there is Krishna. Krishna is the unchanging absolute truth. But Krishna has His Shakti, His energy. And so all the what's called vikara, the changes, all the transformations, including even the transformation of our consciousness from spiritual to material, that is all taking place by the Lord Shakti, and that is all real. That is really happening. It's just, it's not, you see, I sometimes give this analogy to help devotees understand. But the Mayavadi definition of Maya is like a counterfeit bill that is not a copy of any known real money in the world. In other words, like monopoly money.
That's good.
So you have a $1,000 monopoly money bill. You see, okay. Monopoly on the Parker Brothers Monopoly game.
Yeah.
And you take that and you go to the shop to spend it. You know, so you gather up a bunch of groceries and you come all laden, you know, with a grocery cart and your arms full. And the proprietor of the shop is becoming very happy. Oh, big customer today. And then you lay down $1,000 of monopoly money. Well, you know, the guy's just going to look at you and say, you know, either put some real money there, get out. Stop wasting my time. But no. You tried to argue. It's just absurd. But, so that's not even real counterfeit money. You see? That's the Mayavadi sense of Maya. It's just absurd. There's no substance to it at all. Real counterfeit money means it's a $1,000 bill that looks like a real $1,000 bill. And the more it looks like a real $1,000 bill, the more you can delude someone into accepting it as real. And that's what Maya is. It's the delusion of accepting something that is not real as being real. Now you can't do that with a monopoly money bill. You just can't. You can't fool anybody with that. Because it's so far removed from the fundamental truth of real currency in this world. So Maya is, for example, Bhagavatam says Maya is Krishna's reflection, or Brahma Samhita, Chaya Shakti, his reflection or his shadow. But it is based on Krishna. And whatever is emanating from Krishna, whatever comes from Krishna, that is his Shakti, and Shakti means potency, it's real power. Like Prabhupada used to reminisce when he was very small, that he once went outside to play with a pack of matches. And those are those old-fashioned matches. I don't think they make them anymore, really. But there were these type of matches, you could strike them against anything. Mm-hmm. A brick, you know. A wall. Practically anything. Against your own thumb, you see. Yeah. And they would ignite. Now they make matches called safety matches. You need to scratch them against the sandpaper of the package. But previously you could scratch them against anything. So Prabhupada said, when I was a small boy, I once from somewhere got a box of these kind of matches. And Prabhupada said, I wanted to make scratch. So he was scratching and throwing, as kids might do. But one of these matches fell on his own dhoti. He was wearing dhoti at the time, cotton dhoti. And a cotton dhoti is very flammable, so it caught fire. And Prabhupada said, out of nowhere, there was no one around. Prabhupada was in a, I believe, an open field doing this. And there was no one, and suddenly there was one man there. It just seemed to have appeared out of nowhere. And he rolled Srila Prabhupada, who must have been maybe 8 years old, in the grass to put the fire out. But Prabhupada said, I still have one scar. And he used to show the devotees a scar on his leg. I still have the scar on my leg from where I was burnt. So Srila Prabhupada used to use that as a lesson, that don't play with Krishna's energies. Don't think you can just play with Krishna's energies and it's, the result will just be some kind of blissful dream, daydream, in which you get lost for a while and then come out of it. It's not like that at all. So this is the sense in which we accept this Tattvabhad principle, which I think was the point you were making.
Yeah. I think this, that it's, yeah, means one of the transcendental, the path is the same, though the vision is different. But also just that the actual processes given in the Shastra are meant for spiritual realization, though because of consciousness they use them otherwise.
Yeah.
So, and because they're more bulky, let's say the process of karma, doing these big yajnas, then, but we see in previous eight, in Treta Yuga, they do these big yajnas to invoke Vishnu so he'd personally come so they could personally do the worship. So these same yajnas, basically you just adjust them a little bit, and, you know, you get, you know, soma or other things like that. You go to the different heavenly planets or, but the process is actually meant for devotional. So it gives a spiritual result, though the contaminated, you know, consciousness then desires something material, so then it's transferred into material result. Does that make some sense? In other words, we should be, that confidence should be there that actually the whole Vedic process, the way the whole material world functions, is meant for spiritual upliftment. It's not something else. We're not a bunch of, you know, a strange bunch of, you know, how you say oddballs that happen to just be doing this thing in some little corner of the world here. Basically, most of the universe does what we do, though they may be doing it for material purposes, and a small portion of only this planet then do activities that aren't connected with the Vedas and think they're independent. Like that. But you have 6 billion idiots, and other than that, then it's unlimited persons. I mean, it's 33 million demigods themselves, and that means much of their associates then are engaged. Like we see Yamaraj, he has a lot of Yamadutas. I don't think there's just one or two. Right? There's a whole crew. Oh, did he ever tell you how you become a Yamaduta? Did you find that out? Very interesting. Just as a side point, is that people have how do you say? Means those who are religious, then they'll go to, but they're not big religious. You know, means big sacrifices and that. For them, heavenly planet means going to Yamaraj's abode, the Pitri Loka, and it's connected to the moon by some mystic connection. So it is a heavenly planet, but it's kind of like just a, you know. It's heavenly, but it's still not like going to Indra's place or something. So it appears that a bulk amount of people go there. Now, if the descendants perform the Shraddha rites properly, then they get food and water and, you know, facilities, clothes and all those things for the year. So every year it has to be done. So now, that's why they're always concerned that, you know, someone's following nicely and they have a son so that they will perform the Shraddha rites and they'll have a son and it will carry on, because for three generations after you, they have to do that to keep you there. So now, if you have someone who's unfortunate that their descendants do not offer them the Shraddha, then they start to get really hungry and thirsty and no facility and, you know, feeling uncared for. So much time of that, then they start to, like, because it changes the kind of like their mentality, then they end up starting to get a little freaky and start to look like Yamadutas. And when they've gotten desperate enough, then Yamaraj then gives them an engagement as a Yamaduta, and then they're able to take a cut from the other Shraddha rites, you know, so they're maintained like that. So that's why you see is the Yamadutas, because they're there because of following religious principles, but they're not maintained because other people are not. Therefore, they have real issues with people who do not follow the scriptures. You know? So that's why when somebody dies, very enthusiastically, they come there with their dogs and their this and that and really give the person trouble, because here's another one of those people who, you know, made us like we are, you know. So it's...
All the diseases are associates of Yamarajas.
Oh, really?
All the diseases of the world, cancer personified. Right. AIDS personified.
Yeah, which is what is HIV personified. Okay, so verses 5-7. His mind resolved to meet the death fate had ordained. His mind resolved to meet the death fate had ordained for him. The king first of all handed over his kingdom to his son. He then sat down firmly on the banks of the river dearest to the Lord, whose current carries the dust and tulsi leaves of his lotus feet. The king's determination was to give up his life by fasting with his mind firmly concentrated upon the lotus feet of Lord Krishna. Nimishi 4 probably draws our attention to the fact that while the convention is that King Parikit took shelter of the Ganges, in fact the river Jamuna flows through Hastinapur, Delhi, while the Ganges proper does not. The Yamuna is, as Srila Prabhupada points out in the sixth purport, more associated with Sri Krishna than even the Ganges. Her waters are dear to Krishna for carrying the holy dust of the Lord's lotus feet, mixed with tulsi leaves. The Yamuna, being a tributary of the Ganges, may be referred to by that name also. At Prayag, Allahabad, southwest of Delhi, the two rivers meet to become one. In the sixth purport, Srila Prabhupada makes clear that the version of no less than Srila Jiva Goswami is that Maharaj Parikit actually took shelter of the river Yamuna. The Goswami cites the Varaha Purana statement that while there is no difference between the two, still, when the water of the Ganges are sanctified 100 times, it is called the Yamuna. This is compared to the scriptural statement that 1,000 names of Vishnu equals one name of Rama, and 3 names of Rama are equal to one name of Krishna. I think they come. They start separately when they come. Yamuna, and I think you have Bhagirathi, Alakananda, and I forget what the fourth is. Somehow or another, they come out separately. The Ganga comes under Shiva's head, goes down into Manasarovar. Manasarovar. Yeah. Then from there, goes out underneath and comes out at Gomukh and all those places. Then they all come together, but then north of Delhi, then they split into the Ganga and Jamuna, and then again they go back together. So there's that place, and that place, that island between the two, or that land, that's the place of the Kurus. That's like considered, you know, like one of the main best places in India. So it's actually the same river, but it's just the difference being Jamuna's, as rightly pointed out here, is that it's been purified 100 times because of Krishna's pastimes, like that. So that makes it very special. One thing on the fasting is that we see here also an element of culture that means Parikit Maharaj could have gone to the Muni. And, well, one, he could have just not even bothered with the curse because he's more powerful. But since it was a Brahmin who cursed out of respect for the Brahmins, because Krishna respects them, therefore then the curse is accepted. He could have then gone to the rishi and asked for, you know, please, forgiveness and this and that, and then generally the curse can't be taken back, but it can be redirected. It will go, you know, you'll be bit, but you'll be brought back to life, or, you know, something. It means the curse will be kept, but there'll be some adjustment to it that it'll be corrected. But because the rishi had, with such remorse, mentioned about the cursing of his son cursing the Parikshit Maharaj, then Parikshit Maharaj didn't want to embarrass him more. He was already feeling bad enough. So out of that, then, is that here is respecting the curse, the potency of the Brahmin, but also respecting the position or their personal individual. So between him and Samika Rishi, then it's understood. And at the same time, it's because the sage knew that he is self-realized like himself, therefore he made this comment, you know, that you should prepare, because then, you know, it's time for perfecting self-realization. Otherwise, then, if it was a normal king, then, you know, it's not good, but it wouldn't have been such a worry. But because he was special, then we see Samika Rishi made this effort and felt this remorse. Like that.
Seven to 11. News of the emperor's great renunciation spread quickly throughout the universe. On the plea of making a pilgrim's journey, all of the great rishis came there along with their disciples, knowing that Srimad Bhagavatam would be spoken by Sukadeva Goswami. And so Maharaj Parikshit was soon surrounded by such spiritual authorities as Narad Muni, Srila Vyasadeva, Bhrigu, Vasishta, Parasara, Atri, Vishwamitra, Angira, Parasuram, Bharadvaj, Gautama, Chavana, Sharadvan, Utatya, Maitreya, Aurava, as well as numerous other rishis and great kings of the class known as Arunodayas. Maharaj Parikshit received everyone properly, bowing his head before them in the hopes of being excused of all offenses before departing from this world. Nimsha 5. In 9 to 10 purport, Srila Prabhupada outlines the life stories of many of the sages named in these verses. Just a comment. So interesting, they all made excuses that they were just going on some pilgrimage and then, you know, nipping over here. So it was definitely an event no one wanted to miss, like that. So that also shows what a great personality, a great devotee it is. Because, you know, so many kings we see get cursed and nobody shows up, you know, like that. Let alone shows up on an excuse, you know, that they're, you know, going for this, and then they go, you generally do that if it's something you really want to attend to, but you're not sure if others would think it's wise or something, you know, so don't. Okay.
After all had been comfortably seated, Maharaj Parikshit stood before the assembled sages with folded hands and announced, "The Supreme Lord, who is the Supreme Controller, has kindly overtaken me in the form of a Brahmana's curse. The Lord has done this out of his causeless mercy, for I had become too attached to family life and royal opulence. O Brahmanas, please accept me as a completely surrendered soul, for I have already taken the lotus feet of the Lord into my heart. If it be so ordained by the Supreme, let the snake bird Takshika, or whatever magical creation Sringi has unleashed upon me, bite me at once. My only desire is that you continue speaking about the glories of the Supreme Lord Vishnu. I offer my obeisances unto all of you, and I pray that if I have to be born again within this material world, my attachment for Lord Krishna will remain intact, and I may have the association of devotees. I have come here to sit down and fast until death, and so I beg you to instruct me for my highest welfare." After uttering these words, Maharaj Parikshit sat down facing north, on the southern bank of the Ganga, upon a mat of kusa grass that had been placed with the roots turned towards the east. The demigods in heaven expressed their satisfaction with the king's determination by beating their drums and showering flowers. Nimisha 6. In 17th purport, Srila Prabhupada clarifies, the river Ganges is celebrated as the wife of the sea. The seat of Kusa grass, Kusa straw, is considered to be sanctified if the straw is taken out of the earth complete with root. And if the root is pointed towards the east, it is considered to be auspicious. Facing the north is still more favorable for obtaining spiritual success. Maharaj Parikit handed over the charge of administration to his son before leaving home. He was thus fully equipped for all favorable conditions. Nimisha 7. In 18th purport, Srila Prabhupada adds, there is no one in the heavenly planets who is an atheist or non-believer. Thus any devotee of the Lord on the surface of the earth is always praised by them. And in the case of Maharaj Parikit, they were greatly delighted and thus gave tokens of honor by scattering flowers over the earth by beating celestial drums. A demigod takes pleasure in seeing someone go back to Godhead. He is always pleased with the devotee of the Lord. So much so that by his adidaivic powers, he may help the devotee in all respects. And by their actions, the Lord is pleased with them. There is an invisible chain of complete cooperation between the Lord, the demigods, and the devotee of the Lord on earth. This is also a very important point for ourselves, is that we are happy if others advance, and they may advance quicker than us. Because it's like here, one human, that's a lower, in one sense, a lower birth than a demigod. The lifespan is less, so, you know, the human being can no way, even by age, you know, be more mature. Because we're never more than a few, you know, some days, you know, well, technically, but we get basically a little over 3 months compared to the demigods. You know, that's about how long we live. So, but they are happy to see someone advance more than them and go back to Godhead. So it's important, because the tendency will be is because we're older, we made someone a devotee, or we're the senior person, or we're the parent, or whatever is the position that we're in that puts us superior to someone else that was junior to us. As they mature, then we have to be careful that we do not become disturbed, that they may surpass us like that. And so the demigods, these are all great personalities, but they're all coming to respect Maharaj Parikit. They knew something special is going to happen because he's a devotee.
Also, there's a statement from 18P that the demigod takes pleasure in seeing someone go back to Godhead. He is always pleased with the devotee of the Lord, so much so that by his adidaivic powers, he may help the devotee in all respects. So, it's important to note that this adi, I think you're all familiar with these terms, the prasutraya, three types of suffering. You know these terms from that, that there are sufferings that come from the devas, the higher laws of nature. There are sufferings that come from adhyatma, our own body and mind. And then there are sufferings that come from adibhauta, other living entities. But actually, this will come out in the second canto, that this experience of suffering is simply our experience of a higher principle of reformation, which is the principle, Prabhupada explains, the principle of cause and effect, that due to our material desires, you see, the reason we come into this material world is not to suffer. Nobody reads a brochure up in the spiritual world about the glories of the lower planets, you know, how you can, you know, the different 27 or more hells that one can suffer, or the different regions of the earth planet, Marchaloka, where life is so short and miserable. and becomes attracted to that. But what we become attracted to is the principle of cause and effect, that I can be a cause and I can create an effect, and that will be my doing. And as my doing, therefore I can enjoy. I can claim that effect, that result, as my own, and I can enjoy it. So this Adi Daiva, Adi Atma, and Adi Bhauta, on a higher principle, these are higher level, these are the principles of cause and effect that manifest at a certain, this is very early on in the creation, as described in the second canto, they manifest early on in order to create an attractive situation for the jivas to come into this material world. As long as we think, well, if it's just going to be like this, great, I'll go. But the problem is that the jivas come into the material world before the creation is actually done. You see, actually the creation is taking place because we get mixed up in it. Prabhupada explains in a purport in the second canto that actually the whole creation is unfolding as it does to completion only because of the marginal potency of the word. So in that sense, this material world, like I believe it was Satchinandan Maharaj once asked Srila Prabhupada that if Krishna wants us to go back to Godhead, then why did he create Maya? And Prabhupada this was in London, Prabhupada very sternly replied, Krishna did not create Maya, you did. So Krishna, in this form of his vyuha expansions, is displaying his material potencies in different ways. He has his bina prakriti and abhina prakriti. The prakriti which is non-different from him, and the prakriti that is different from him. So he's, as Vasudeva, Sankarshan, Pradumna, Aniruddha, he is displaying the prakriti which is different from him. As Vasudeva, it's only a little bit different from him. Prabhupada actually says the material energy at that point, at the point of Vasudeva, and we'll get into this in great detail in the second canto, is spiritual. He actually describes it as spiritual. Material energy is spiritual. He uses this term. It's transcendental. It's transcendental or spiritual in the sense that it's not really doing anything. It's just acting as the shadow of the Lord. But as the jivas become attracted to that and become involved in it, become attracted to different features of this reflection of the Lord in the Mahatattva, then various, so many different kinds of reactions come into play. And the jiva simultaneously is becoming more and more and more entangled. And in the end, well, here we are, 8,400,000 species of life. This is the effect of the cause that we are responsible for. We became the cause of our, like Prabhupada said, man is architect of his destiny. So we became the cause of our destiny, whatever it is. Like Prabhupada once said, you want to know what is your karma? Just look in the mirror. You see, this body is your karma. You have created that. Nobody else created that for you. Nobody else cursed you. You know, some other power cursed you by giving you this body, this mind. This is a result of your own work, your own karma, your own desire. So, All of that goes back. You can't trace out the beginning of it. But there is an original principle, the Adi-Daiva principle. The Adi-Daiva principle means the controlling principle. There is an original principle. And that Adi-Daiva principle is actually the Vach-Shakti. So the Vach-Shakti, Vach, from the Sanskrit word Vach, we get the word voice. So the Lord's own instructions, when Lord Mahavishnu lies down and breathes out the universe, simultaneously he's breathing out the Veda. And Prabhupada said the Veda is giving the blueprint or the plan. Actually, in explaining this, Prabhupada gave the example of the dictaphone that he was using to dictate the Srimad Bhagavatam. He said when you buy a dictaphone, you get one brochure, one manual, which contains all the instructions how to use the machine. So similarly, at the time of creation, the Lord is giving all the directions for how we should properly live in this material world. So this is what is meant here when Prabhupada is saying that a demigod takes pleasure in seeing someone go back to Godhead. He is always pleased with the devotee of the Lord, so much so that by his adi-daivic powers, he may help the devotee in all respects. So adi-daivic, you see, that means that then we're following the order of the Lord. And these demigods were representatives of that order in different departments. Then they will assist the devotee on his way back, going back to Godhead. But if we continue to cling to our own idea, you see, in other words, I've got my own plan, I want to be cause in my own way, I want to create my own result, I want to enjoy that result in my own way separately, then, yes, we're still under the adi-daivic potency, but it's experienced as klesh, as suffering, because by that attitude we have broken with the instructions of the Lord, with the order of the Lord. And then the demigods are not pleased with us, and they punish us in different ways. Back to you, Maharaj.
Are you drinking? The rishis that were assembled there also praised Maharaj Parikshit with sweet words, saying, "O King, it is not astonishing that you have renounced your royal position, that you may without hindrance attain the eternal association of Lord Krishna. We shall remain here until you pass away from this mortal body, and thus attain to the supreme abode of the Supreme Lord." Desiring to hear about Lord Krishna, Maharaj Parikshit once again addressed the sages. "You have kindly assembled here from all over the universe and are naturally inclined to do good to others. Please tell me what is the unalloyed duty of everyone in all circumstances, and especially of those who are just about to die." Nimisha 8. With regard to the king's mentioning that the sages had gathered from all over the universe, in 23rd purport, Srila Prabhupada points out that even the personified Vedas from Satyaloka were present in the assembly. In 24th purport, Srila Prabhupada states that the king actually placed two questions before the sages. 1. What is the duty of a human being in all circumstances? And 2. What is his specific duty when facing death? These queries are not easily answered, for as Srila Prabhupada notes in 24th purport, "Practically the whole of the Srimad Bhagavatam, beginning from the second canto up to the last 12th canto, deals with these two questions." End quote. Maharaj Parikshit, the greatest Mahabhagavata among the Kshatriya class of his time, knew very well that devotional service to Lord Krishna is the only real answer to both questions. He humbly petitioned the Brahmana, sages to confirm their acknowledgement of the method of liberation he knew to be Shuddha or perfectly correct. Parikshit hoped their answer would be unanimous so that he might carry out his duty without controversy. Difficulty is that different sages recommend different processes. Some of them first class, as the king hoped for.
but others second and third class, just as doctors will differently diagnose the same patient. So it appears that the great sages also put forward various opinions.
Because he was already a devotee, so he was wanting to know, confirm that, and he had heard so many things. But it's the culture, even you know something, when you're in front of a senior, you do not present yourself as, you know, so intelligent. So you will confirm by asking them, discussing with them, just to confirm, because when mind is focused, you're completely committed to something, your result will be very good. And if the mind is not focused, then the result can't be good, because it doesn't have the same force. Right? Some things, you put all energy on one point, it has much more effect than if you spread it out over a large area. Right? So here then he wants to confirm this so that it can go forward. Another is that all these sages came, then if the mood is all, it was one mood, then it makes for a very pleasant environment. Everybody's on the same kind of like wavelength. So then then that makes a nice atmosphere, so nothing's disturbed in that. Another thing is that being a devotee, it's natural that everybody is then committed to hearing and chanting the glories of the Lord, so that will benefit even those who are not. So it means great personalities came, but because they're all different, those who are not devotees, then they would be benefited. Or let's say they're not, so strict, they may be more into yoga or other mystic things. Then that way, then the whole assembly is devotionally inclined. So then that's also natural, because he's one of the Mahabhagavats. So the Mahabhagavats like to see everybody else. So a few other Mahabhagavats are there. You know, Vyasa was there, Narad was there. I think Shiva may have come like this. So there was quite a assemblage of Mahabhagavats. But so then the natural thing is to bring it in line with Krishna consciousness. Like that.
Hmm. It's interesting.
Oh yeah, two questions.
That some things came to mind as I was hearing this. The Prabhupada's concern in the very early days of ISKCON, when his disciples proposed to invite one or more of his god brothers. I think that question was coming up because Prabhupada was gaining success in the West, and as he gained success, his god brothers who had previously ignored his endeavors suddenly, you know, started to show some interest.
Yeah.
And the proposal came up that someone among the god brothers or followers of the Gaudiya might be invited by the ISKCON devotees to come to the temples in the West and preach Krishna consciousness. And Srila Prabhupada, I think there was some discussion back and forth, but Srila Prabhupada finally, he told his disciples that first he expressed his own unswerving faith in the order of his own spiritual master. And I think that is, we can take some reference from that to the controversies that broke out in the Gaudiya Math after the departure of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Because, as I think most of you know, the Gaudiya Math, there was a lot of trouble, and it split up in different ways. No need to go over that history, but the point is that Srila Prabhupada made it clear that he himself maintained his own personal conviction bedrock conviction, unshakable conviction in Krishna consciousness by simply keeping in his heart what he has heard from his spiritual master. So that was one point. And then he went on from there to say, and if someone comes and says simply one word different from me, then it will ruin everything. So Prabhupada was concerned about the very delicate neophyte faith of his young Western disciples, that they might hear something that sounds different from what Srila Prabhupada, and this actually happened actually, after some of Srila Prabhupada's disciples went to India, when they did, they were party to hearing things that sounded differently from what Srila Prabhupada taught, and that did create quite a disturbance in the early days. So Srila Prabhupada was very concerned about that. So I was thinking about that, but yet at the same time, as we see here, in the mature Vedic culture, that seems to be just part of the scene, that you have different great sages who are authorities in different areas of Vedic knowledge. And for whatever, I mean, there's no reason, there's no point in getting psychoanalytic about it, but for whatever reason, if the question is put before such sages, what is the single most important thing that is the duty of a human being, especially when faced with death, that they may answer in different ways. And we find here that it is the greatness of Maharaj Parikshit that, like you said, he was before superiors, so he in a sense accepted their different opinion, not for himself, but he accepted that this is the way things are, and he didn't lose faith. He didn't because I always think of in the Buddhist scriptures, they describe the situation in India just before the appearance of Lord Buddha. And they say at the time, just before Buddha took birth, there was all over India 62 different philosophies. In other words, 62, we know that there are six systems, but somehow they had multiplied into 62, which is, of course, possible. When you have speculation on top of speculation on top of speculation and mixing and all of that. So there were 62 main philosophical schools, and everyone was confused. And therefore, there was a lot of faithlessness already in the air. There were a lot of people who were just doubtful about what is the goal of life. There were a lot of people who were mistrustful of the Brahmanas, were speaking in all these different ways. They no longer understood. They could no longer understand what is the real point of the Vedic knowledge. And so Lord Buddha came, and one of his famous statements that actually Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur himself used to quote, you know, because sometimes as devotees, see, if even a great devotee like Bhaktivinoda Thakur, we get asked how do Prabhupada call it, these hair-splitting questions, you know. But what about, then you give an answer, but what about, you give an answer to that, but what about, you give an answer to that, but what about, what, it just goes on without, just splitting hairs, splitting hairs, splitting hairs. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur finally, and he was actually quoting Lord Buddha, that if you're shot with an arrow, what do? And I mean, do you sit there, an arrow sticking out of your chest, you're bleeding all over the place, and you sit there and speculate Where did this arrow come from? How fast was it going when it came? What direction did it come from? What angle was it fired at? How far did it travel before it hit me?
Okay. How many pounds was the bow?
How many pounds of pull weight was the bow that fired this arrow? Why did the person shoot this arrow? Blah, blah. You can go on asking these questions, but in the meantime, you're dying. You see? In the meantime, you're bleeding to death. And that's not going to help you. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, we must learn to safely pull this arrow out and take the proper treatment to heal the wound so that we won't die. Well, it was actually Lord Buddha. That's a very famous statement by Lord Buddha, because he would also, because of all these different philosophies floating around, he would get asked all these questions. And he would often give this example as his answer, and he would say, I have not come to engage with you in philosophical debate. I have come to show you the way to become relieved of suffering. Because that's the first principle of Buddhist philosophy, is dukkha. You are suffering. And then it goes on to say how you can relieve yourself. Of course, this is not the ultimate. Buddhism does not teach the ultimate solution to suffering. But, as Prabhupada says, Lord Buddha came to teach sub-religious principles. But the thing is, people have become so irreligious, so confused by what the Brahmins, these different philosophies, and especially the use of this philosophy to condone animal slaughter in the name of animal sacrifice, which was creating very sinful reactions for society. So Buddha simply came to stop all that. And so he used to give this simple example. So I was reflecting on that, how a great devotee like Maharaj Pritchard does not become bewildered, even when he hears apparent controversy, or contradiction rather, between great Vedic sages. Of course, they were great Vedic sages, that's another thing. This is prior to Kali Yuga.
No, it's just in Kali Yuga. It's before it's really effective.
Well, Krishna, yeah.
I mean, this is the
first. Yeah, that's right. Krishna had departed.
Yeah, but this is the first
Kali
thing
was
Kali
just
got
looking
in.
For his way in.
Well, this is the way he got
in.
Yeah,
and he was just coming in. But this is prior to the degradation of. Sringi was the first example of a degraded Brahmana. So until that point, no other Brahmana had become degraded.
Mm. Yeah.
But Buddha appeared a little bit after that, and more Brahmanas have become degraded. So it makes things worse when they're giving deliberately misleading answers.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly justifying animal slaughter in the name of animal sacrifice, which is what they were doing. Therefore, Lord Buddha said he rejected the whole Vedic process as a provision.
Yeah.
But that is a quality of pure devotee. Very firm faith. Nishta. Yeah, that's nishta. No matter what one hears, his own conviction in Krishna consciousness is never shaken. Chapter 9.
Thank you
very much.
Yes.
So,
continue tomorrow.
Now Monday morning. So, we'll again meet tomorrow. Same time, same place.
Same station.
And continue with chapter 19. Chapter 1. Thank you very much. Okay. Prabhupada
Ki Jai.